dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I respect greatly and whose expertise, particularly with respect to Asia, we are privileged to tap regularly is David Goldman, better known perhaps as Spengler for his wonderful columns in Asia Times. He is also the author of a brand new book, You Will Be Assimilated. David, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back. Wonderful to have a chance to talk with you on the eve of a very big deal. I mean, big in the largest sense of the word, I guess. Ant Technology Group is a company that is a Chinese conglomerate associated with, partly owned by Alibaba. And it is about to bring to market an IPO substantially enabled by what I call Beijing's bankers on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup. There are reports, David, that this is going to be a runaway success, perhaps raising as much, I was told today, as $90 billion, vastly exceeding any other IPO in history. What do you make of it?
Well, there are $90 billion in orders out there. The IPO itself will be for $40 billion, so you could expect it to probably trade up in the secondary market. So if you're part of the consortium, you can distribute stock to your friends. That gives you an enormous amount of power. And in fact, the Chinese government has handed Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and other American banks a huge profit opportunity for managing the IPO. So you could call it a political bribe, but American investment banks will make out like bandits on this.
I do want to talk about it as a political bribe, if I could, because it does seem as though that's pretty much what's going on here, David, that we're seeing capitalists, financiers, and others that are simply deciding, even though there are some significant risk, we believe, associated with this IPO, with human rights issues and national security issues, for that matter, that they're going to profit by it and the devil take the hindmost. Is that what's going on?
Well, there are two things going on, Frank. Ant Financial represents a highly sophisticated application of artificial intelligence to making small loans and organizing transactions with a customer base of nearly 1 billion people. It's like nothing the financial world has seen before. It's revolutionary. Think of it as the TikTok of finance. You have a base of nearly a billion users, and the amount of information you can acquire about creditworthiness, consumer behavior, and so forth is just staggering. We are, in the United States, we don't have anything like that. So everyone in the world wants to get in on what they believe to be the financial future. And the scary thing is the Chinese are getting ahead of us in artificial intelligence, and artificial intelligence is the key to the economy of the 21st century.
I want to pivot on that basis to the company that you just mentioned as well, TikTok, another AI intense application, and one that has been, of course, front and center in the U.S.-China challenging relationship, let's say, for the past few weeks, because President Trump has said, as did Narendra Modi of India before him, we're not going to let TikTok operate in our country. David, what's your current reading on the emerging deal between Oracle and Walmart on the one hand and ByteDance, the owner of TikTok? Is this likely to pass muster in the end? And if it does, will that address some of the concerns that you have about TikTok's AI in the service of China's operations?
I don't know if the deal will pass muster. I think there's no question but that Oracle and Walmart want to piggyback onto this spectacular artificial intelligence advance that you have in TikTok. The thing about AI is, Frank, is it's stupid. What makes it smart is vast data sets. They have 2 billion downloads globally. which is like nothing else in the world. So the amount of information you can gather about human behavior from 2 billion people is an incredible advantage. That's why President Trump is so concerned about keeping the American data in the United States, because data is the resource. Like, data is the great resource of this century, and he's right to do it. Oracle has promised that data will be safeguarded, but they won't get the Chinese software. Now, I don't know enough about the technical details to know exactly where we ought to cut the line. The risk is that China will say, okay, you don't want to do business with us. You're just a couple, you know, if you're a few hundred million people, you're 165 million downloads. That's 8% of our 2 billion database. The Indians clearly have said, we don't want China to control AI in India. We want to do that ourselves. So they've banned the app there. And there's always a trade-off between piggybacking on Chinese knowledge and advances and learning what they're doing and trying to keep them from getting the advantage of this massive data set. So I think President Trump is right to be concerned about this. I think that the negotiations are extremely difficult, and exactly where the line has to be cut requires somebody with more detailed expertise about these issues than I can get looking from the outside.
But I think you did put your finger on the point that concerns most of us, and that is if the software, the algorithms specifically, that power TikTok remain in Chinese hands, which seems to be the case for the deal at the moment, at least, that is likely to continue to cause concerns about the security of personal information and the possibility that it may be used as a means of influencing Americans, perhaps in political terms, among other things. David, let me ask you about one other thing, because it's central to your new book, You Will Be Assimilated, of course, and you've emphasized this point about big data. In the midst of the coronavirus, which, of course, was unleashed on us by the Chinese Communist Party, you have an opportunity that the Chinese have apparently seized to try to move into this healthcare space in a big way, to collect data worldwide as part of their response to the virus, among other things. Just give us a quick minute about that and what it portends for our country as well as others around the world.
In my book, I interviewed the chief technology officer of Huawei, who said, we expect to get hundreds of millions of people in the next few years around the world integrated into our AI analysis of healthcare, which means everyone's health records are digitized, DNA is sequenced, and your vital signs are uploaded daily via smartphone attachments. And what that gives you is not only, obviously, a great deal of advantage in controlling pandemics, much more important, pharmaceutical research increasingly will be based on these enormous data sets. So all the world's pharmaceutical companies, particularly the Europeans, are lining up to do joint ventures with China big data companies to get in on this research advantage. And the real danger is that if China is able to do this and we lag behind because our crazy quilt of privacy laws makes it very difficult for the likes of Microsoft or Google to get hold of this data, then China will leap ahead of us in terms of pharmaceutical and other medical research. And that's where we really have to be careful, because that's a critical technological advantage.
David, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we're hard out of time, but thank you. Never hard out of topics to discuss with you. We look forward to doing so again with you next week. Thank you for your time today, as always. Next up, we'll speak more about China, its doctrine, its ambitions, with Jeff Nyquist. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to welcome back as well Jeff Nyquist, better known perhaps by his pen name J.R. Nyquist. We just call him Jeff around here, and I'm very pleased to have him around here as often as we can get him, because he's one of the brightest minds on, well, national security issues in general, but particularly on one of the most important topics in that space, China. And we're privileged to be able to visit with him. He's been writing frequently about the subject at his blog, jrnyquist.blog. He has been thinking about these things and addressing them in longer form in several books, including The Origins of the Fourth World War and his new book, The Fool and His Enemy. Jeff Nyquist, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. I want to say thank you because yesterday you and one of our other colleagues and fellow members of the Committee on the Present Danger China, Sam Faddis, participated in a Center for Security Policy webinar, which is available at securefreedom.org. It was a superb discussion between the two of you about what we're facing in the form of a present and growing danger from China. And just quickly, sort of reprise, if you would, the key points that you made in the course of that important conversation, Jeff.
Well, of course, the reason China is a threat and why it's important now is that, well, it's a word we don't like using. China is an enemy, and its ruling party is the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party, which is a Marxist-Leninist party. And if you look at what the teachings of that party are, it is the destruction of capitalism, the overthrow of the capitalist system, and the destruction of imperialist America as the center of that system. So the entire way in which the philosophy of the ruling revolutionary theory of China operates is to destroy us.
But Jeff, let me just ask you about this, if I could, because, you know, it's been a thesis of those who have been promoting the idea of engaging with China, well, for decades now, that by doing so, we will wean them from this kind of hostility and ideological ambitions. And to some extent, you actually hear people saying, well, they don't really mean all of that anyway. How do you respond to those, assertions?
You know, a lot of people who, you know, and this would come from the business community who want to do business in China, they really think, well, communism is an ideology and that nobody believes in ideology. And it's, they see everything in terms of utility and pragmatism. Well, they don't understand that actually ideas like communism are real to the people who are communists. That's a very special thing to be. And for a system to be predicated on it, going back to its founder, Mao Zedong, it is not insignificant. And just simply because you want to make money and that you want this global capitalist system, oh, the Chinese are really capitalists, they're not really Marxists anymore. Well, you know that the indoctrination of the military officers and the People's Liberation Army is Marxist-Leninist indoctrination. And if you've ever met your scholars from the People's Republic and you've had a chance to discuss with them these subjects, oh yeah, they take Marxism-Leninism seriously. And privately, they'll even admit to you they believe in it. And I had a Chinese friend for a while, and he said, well, I know Mao did bad things, but I love Mao anyway. I mean, it was kind of shocking. This is a fellow my own age. And the people ruling China are people in their 60s, people my age, people your age. I would ask him, why do you love Mao? Why is that? Well, it's just the associations in my childhood. It was what I was raised on.
But Jeff, there's another thing at work here, I think it's fair to say, and you've deeply studied, totalitarianism, both in China and elsewhere. And one of its hallmarks, of course, is there are real costs to deviating from the party line, whatever it may be, whether it's loving Mao or whether it's overthrowing the United States or something else. If you don't embrace and extol and seek to advance whatever that agenda may be, you could wind up dead or in a prison camp or otherwise punished, especially under the Chinese social credit system. Is that not right?
Yeah. Well, there's nothing so serious as an idea that people are willing to kill for. And this is another thing. There is, in the structure of the totalitarian ideas, is a kind of inversion of the ideas of what we would call normal organic society, our civilization. And Marxism is one of these things that seems to be an inversion of the values of our civilization, which we should take seriously. And when we talk about totalitarians as being criminals, that's another dimension. Okay, they're violent and they're serious, but there's this criminal aspect. And this, I would warn for politicians and businessmen, you know who you're shaking hands with. That person's a mass murderer. You know, when Nixon went to China, he sat down with a mass murderer. Now, if he'd gone and sat down next to Hitler, what would people have said?
Well, they didn't speak well of Neville Chamberlain when he did it. And a lot of people lost their lives and immense damage of other kinds ensued from his appeasement. So, Jeff, when you're talking about that criminal element, we discussed this a little bit yesterday, that the transnational criminal organization character of the Chinese Communist Party. And it seems to me that if they were so designated, as they certainly should be on the facts, it might make it a little bit more difficult, if not actually illegal, for some of those capitalists, some of those businessmen, some of those particularly Wall Street financiers that I call Beijing's bankers, to be enabling and underwriting their criminal enterprise, because it would make such individuals and their companies accomplices to that criminal conduct, would it not?
Yeah, it would make them accomplices. I mean, just think, would these people want to be seen in a local restaurant with a pimp or a mob boss? I mean, this is much worse, really, because these criminals, it isn't just that they're criminals. They're criminals who want to, they're like super criminals who want to destroy and have destroyed whole countries. I mean, you look at Tibet, you look at the Uyghurs, you look at what's happening now in terms of the Chinese people in Hong Kong. The number of murders, there may be as many as 10,000 people in Hong Kong missing since the recent uprising there in Hong Kong.
And 500,000 Tibetans, we're just hearing, are now being sent off to these prison camps, like the ones that have between 1 and maybe as many as 3 million Uyghurs in them in East Turkestan, as it's called. Jeff, this is so important for calibrating, it seems to me, what we're up against. And if we don't recognize it as such, we're doomed, I'm afraid, to find ourselves submitting to it. Which brings me to the other thing that I think was a very important takeaway from our conversation with you and Sam Faddis. I think it was Sam who mentioned this, but like your sort of reaction to it. He's been doing some great work. We've talked about it with him often on this program, but at AND Magazine, Sam, who has a background, of course, in the Central Intelligence Agency and countering insurrections and other elements responsible for trying to overthrow governments in foreign countries. And one of the things that he's been looking into assiduously is evidence that there may be foreign support for Antifa and the Black Lives Matter organization and the Freedom Road Socialist organization and the Liberation Road and other fronts that are very much involved. It appears in places like Louisville overnight and certainly in other cities around the country. He mentioned something called the Chinese Progressive Association. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but evidently they're tied directly to Chinese consulates in Boston and Hong Kong. Knowing what you do, Jeff Nyquist, about the Chinese Communist Party and its United Fronts Department and its doctrine and ambitions to destroy this country, would you be surprised if there is a Chinese connection to this revolutionary activity in America today?
I would be surprised if there wasn't a connection. I mean, you go back to the LA riots back in, what was it, January, February 1992, and I don't know if it got out into the national news, but local news in Southern California was that the LA County Sheriff had evidence that the Revolutionary Communist Party was involved in the riots. And the Revolutionary Communist Party, of course, is a Maoist communist group. It was in those days stronger here in the West Coast, but I think it's gone all over the country now. And it's connected to these other groups that you named, like Freedom Road and Liberation Road, socialist organizations. And I remember a spokesman of the Revolutionary Communist Party back after the LA riots came on one of the local LA talk shows and bragged about organizing the riots, particularly the burning of buildings. If you remember, there was buildings lit up in the LA riots. So this kind of activity, which we saw in Twin Cities and New York and other places, and the looting, which also in the LA riots, looting was a big part of it. These are things that are actually organized, and they're part of tactics that the communists have been working through and organizing for decades. And these are the Chinese connected Maoist, you know, Marxist-Leninists.
They embrace the same doctrine. They embrace the same modus operandi, that is to say, you know, the techniques for advancing people's war or revolutionary activity. And they certainly are inside our wire, busily working now to destroy us from within and perhaps with this foreign enemy from without. Jeff Nyquist, we're hard out of time. Thank you for yours today. As always, we really appreciate your visits with us and look forward to one next week. Meantime, please, folks, follow Jeff Nyquist at jrnyquist.blog. Be well, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Bradley Thayer will drill down a bit more on captive nations that the Chinese Communist Party is now making an example of, and the ones that they seek to make captive nations in the future. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have any of our team on the Committee on the Present Danger of China. I'm particularly pleased to have one who is among the most thoughtful and articulate critics of the Chinese Communist Party and what it is doing, well, I think in the country today, and certainly a leading figure in the world for that matter. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a professor of political science at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and he is the author of How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Bradley Thayer, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back. It's good to have you. There's a very interesting development that's taking place, and I wanted to sort of kick this around with you a little bit. Obviously, in the course of this election campaign, China is very much in focus, the more so because, of course, of the coronavirus pandemic that the CCP unleashed on us. Less well understood, it seems to be, but really important to appreciating just how dangerous the Chinese Communist Party is, Brad, is the fact that it has enslaved a number of sovereign nations over its history. Specifically Manchuria and southern Mongolia and Tibet, and of course the Uyghurs, East Turkestan, as they call it. These are what, in the Cold War context, we would call captive nations. And it seems to me that it would be very important for us to understand what being a captive nation under a Chinese communist-dominated system looks like. We hear a lot about Uyghur concentration camps, now Tibetans in concentration camps, the Mongolians being denied the ability to learn and even speak their language, and so on. Talk a little bit about what Han centrism means for those who are subjected to its supremacist domination.
Thank you, Frank. I'm pleased to. Han centrism looks at other nations as being inferior to the Han, the vast majority of the Chinese people, approximately 92% of the Chinese people. And that belief helps to legitimize the second order status of many minority groups within China. Those minorities might be religious minorities to some degree, but also ethnic or national minorities. As you observe, the Manchu, the Mongols, the Tibetans, and Kazakh and Uyghur Muslims in East Turkestan, or what the Chinese call Xinjiang. They're perpetually in that status. That is, that they are inferior, even though they're, by Chinese law, everyone is equal, of course, in that respect. But in actual practice, minority groups are forced to assimilate very, very heavily. As we're seeing with the Tibetan camps that you mentioned, the camps in Xinjiang for Uyghur and Kazakh Muslims. And we should anticipate that that's going to become worse, particularly as Xi is quite determined to be an equal of Mao. He's determined to take China forward by 2049, to be the dominant state in international politics. He's advancing Chinese influence in international politics through the Belt and Road Initiative and other institutions the Chinese have created. And the treatment of minorities allows us to identify that as China becomes more powerful, there's no difference in the way that the Chinese treat their minority versus the way they'll treat other countries, right? That other countries should be subordinate and are inferior to China, you know, to the Han.
So, Brad, let me ask you about this. That's a very ominous sign, given how oppressive the Chinese Communist Party is towards these minority populations. I mentioned concentration camps. There's forced sterilization taking place. There's this brutal indoctrination, re-education, torture, among other things. Not least, and this is one that really I find just mind-bogglingly horrible to contemplate, and that is the practice in the Uyghur communities of inserting into the homes of men who have been sent off to the prison camps or slave labor factories, for that matter, Han Chinese men who proceed not only to take up residence, but to sleep with the women in the households. This is, you know, a form of supremacism as well as demographic transformation, as well as a, you know, instrument of psychological warfare against those men in the camps, is it not?
Indeed, it is. It's an effort which is in accord with Maoism of humiliating the opposition, not simply controlling them, but in forcing them to cooperate in their own oppression. And so these horrible activities, the forced sterilizations, all of their policies towards Uyghur and Kazakh Muslim families, as you observed, is obviously a major human rights violation. And attention should be called to it in a way that it has not thus far. But we need to understand that, again, this is a hazard of Xi's rule, right, that he does have that Maoist approach. He's a fervent Maoist. He believes in the ideology. And as a result of that, all of his opponents are going to be crushed, whether those are opponents within the party or whether those are other nations or whether those are other states in international politics.
Crushed by force is part of this tradition, is it not? And we talked a little bit about this doctrine and this, you know, ambition with Jeff a moment ago, but let me broaden the lens on this with you because of your important work on exposing how China sees the world, Brad, and this Han supremacism in the mix. You touched on the Belt and Road Initiative. The way I see it, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, you have the captive nations that are being subjected to this kind of horror. The Chinese people don't fare so well either, for that matter. But what is in prospect for the countries that are succumbing to this Belt and Road debt trap process, it seems, is enslavement in turn by them or for them by the Chinese Communist Party. Talk about what we're seeing in the nature of the Chinese expropriation of natural resources or infrastructure, much of it built with this sort of payday loan scheme, financing by the Chinese banks and so on. Is really it an exaggeration to say they're next in terms of captive nations?
In some respects, they already are. If we consider when China goes abroad, it exploits the natural environment as well as exploiting people, other peoples in Africa, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, worldwide. We've seen this, that Chinese behavior is marked by exploitation of peoples and of the environment. So it's not a surprise, given the Chinese approach, Han centrism at one level, but also Maoism as advanced by Xi, that other states are going to be subordinate to China and to yield to China's demands and desires. And we have seen this consistently. Pakistan is, in some respects, the ideal case of this, where the Pakistanis have, Pakistani elite largely have sold out to China. As a result of that, Chinese exploitation within Pakistan and subordination of maybe Pakistan's independent interests to Chinese interests is in lockstep, very unfortunately. And we could see that that model is going to be replicated elsewhere in areas where the Chinese are attempting to expand their influence, which is worldwide, from the Arctic really to the Antarctic and everything in between.
Everything in between. And, you know, it does strike me that we talk on this program a lot with you and others, Bradley Thayer, about what our own elite, particularly our business elite, has been doing to sell out to China as well. I'm thinking specifically about financiers on Wall Street and some capitalists that have essentially put themselves in the service of the Chinese Communist Party. We call them Beijing's bankers here. And I was told this morning that this Ant Group Technology initial public offering that will be used by Xi Jinping, make no mistake about it, as evidence that China has been able to crush freedom in Hong Kong with impunity, may raise as much as $90 billion, far and away the largest IPO in history, thanks to the help that they would get with fundraising for this purpose. A very problematic Chinese company, by the way, with American investors, most of them unwitting investors in the Chinese Communist Party and its business operations. We have to leave it at that, Brad, for the moment, but thank you for these insights into what's making this enemy so dangerous and why we must, in this election season particularly, ensure that the next commander-in-chief, whoever that may be, has a mandate to resist robustly and counter effectively the Chinese Communist Party. Brad, we look forward to talking with you again soon. Thank you for your time today and the work you do at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Come back to us soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the enemy within and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by a former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. His name is Robert Charles. He is a longtime public servant, having back in the day worked in the Reagan White House as well as that of George H.W. Bush. He has been a very prominent contributor to the public policy debate, particularly about national security matters, notably at Fox News, and of course on the pages of the Association of Mature American Citizens, which is AMAC.us, an organization for which he is a spokesman. And we're always pleased to have him. He has been mulling some of the same things that we're concerned about, and I look forward to having a chance to visit a little bit with him about it. Robert, it's good to have you back. Welcome. So let's start with the rioting last night in Louisville, Kentucky. Predictable and apparently not spontaneous. There's signs that in this instance, as in others, there is some organized effort at work. You've spent a fair amount of time in the law enforcement community. You also were a naval intelligence officer. What do you make of what we know and what we have reason to suspect is the force operating behind these various front groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter, for example?
You know, Frank, I think there are similarities between the world of physics and the world of politics. And one of the principles of physics is that water runs downhill and looks for weaknesses. And organized groups, and we've seen them, I've worked in countries all over the world where organized groups pre-plan to destabilize based on spikes in instability that come from something else. They ride the wave, if you will. And they're looking for points of weakness. So in knowing that a grand jury was going to make a decision, they sort of preloaded this situation in Kentucky, as they have in several others around the country. And your point about organization is it reinforces the sober nature of this moment, quite frankly, because I have law enforcement officer friends all over the country, some of whom who have corroborated to me with clarity that piles of bricks are being pre-laid in places for use. There are clearly organized forces here who want to, at the very least, destabilize this election cycle. At the very least, they want to create the kind of confusion and fear that will somehow justify illegitimizing or delegitimizing the outcome of this election, which I increasingly think is going in one direction, which is in favor of the president. But I also think there's a bigger force at work here, and we've heard increasing amounts of sort of corroborated information suggesting money coming from China and other locations may be behind a lot of the Maoist, or I call it Maoist, it's really Marxist thinking, although they're hard to distinguish. And the idea is that they want to destabilize to the point of upsetting our government. And they're certainly doing it at the state and local level. And I think strength from people like William Barr and President Trump and, you know, Secretary Pompeo, and it's extremely important.
It is, and we need more of it in evidence as well. I want to bring to your attention, Bobby, a conversation, very interesting conversation I had for a full hour with a former senior FBI official by the name of Oliver Buck Revell. I don't know if you know Buck, but he's quite accomplished in the Bureau. And he was telling me that basically he thinks that the Bureau is doing its job with respect to the monitoring of these various groups and trying to contend with them, but that there's a certain lack of political will to really crack down on them, as we must, quite clearly. How do you see that?
Well, let's think about the political process we live in. It depends to some degree on civic honor at some level in every town and state in the country. And I say that because several things. Rule of law requires a number of things. It requires trust in the civil order, but it also requires time. I mean, when you build a case, just to start out in terms of prosecution, when you build a case, and having clerked on the Ninth Circuit and litigated myself, I can say it takes time to both build and defend a case. And in this country, we allow that to happen. We have rights embedded in our Bill of Rights that make it crystal clear that you have time to defend a case. The problem we've got right now is that these groups are taking advantage of all the gaps. A civil society is free. Ours is a civil society that functions in a way that allows the freedoms of our Bill of Rights to take wing, has to accommodate certain things. And they're taking advantage of those gaps. In terms of the FBI, you know, there are joint interagency task forces in every state involving virtually every issue you could imagine, but particularly on things like this sort of instability or counter-narcotics or counterterrorism, domestic or international. So I have no doubt the FBI is involved. William Barr, you know, I know other people wonder, why isn't he moving quicker? Why isn't he pushing Durham to move faster on his probe? I guess I think that credibility relates to process, and process requires time. And the bad guys know that if they can somehow upend enough of the country, people will lose trust in the process because we haven't had time to execute. But I will say this, if they had to move in immediately anywhere, the 10th Amendment notwithstanding, I think the 10th Amendment stands as the powers lie at the state and local level and with the people, unless they are expressly placed in the hands of the federal government. But if a town or a state became massively destabilized, I think the president would probably first exercise his power to put law enforcement in place there at the federal level. He'd then exercise Title 10 to put the National Guard in place at the federal level. And if necessary, he would use the Insurrection Act. And I don't think we're there yet, but I think there are people out there who want that to happen. And that's why I say we have to be attentive to it.
We do indeed. And I'm not sure we addressed adequately the question, is the FBI on top of this case? But we'll come back to that on another day. Let me just turn to this, because since we last talked, Bobby, as you know, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, ending a long and distinguished career in the court and in the country. There is now about to be a major fight over her replacement on the court, with the president announcing his nominee on Saturday. This seems likely to translate into a new catalyst for possibly violent activities, certainly turmoil in the country. Bobby, how does that play in, as you see it, to the election train wreck that I think is headed our way? And is there anything that can be done to avoid a protracted period of uncertainty about who has, in fact, been elected president?
You know, that's probably the biggest worry of the moment, because obviously once the election is done, there's room to move in and sort of stabilize what hasn't been stabilized, and some of the sources of this dissipate. I wish I had a crystal ball. I do think that the Ginsburg, her passing will give the progressives, and in particular those who instantaneously want to use this or abuse this moment to create distrust and instability, they will use it that way. I guess the president and William Barr and other law enforcement personnel, as well as, frankly, I think every member of the United States Congress ought to be up in front of a microphone saying, we are a civil society. We do not abide violence. We do not believe that rioting is a way of voicing grievance. We do believe in assembly. We do believe in speech. We do not believe in violence. But I'm not hearing that from anybody on the Democrat side. I am hearing it on the Republican side. I do think the election is going to be difficult. I think if it's an overwhelming turnout one way or the other, my guess is that even though we'll have somewhere between 6 days minimum, and I think the end of the month to figure out what really happened, and I do fear ballots being somehow mysteriously found to tip states that are key states, that has happened in the past, and we don't want that happening now. But I guess I have confidence that the process will follow through, and maybe I'm the inveterate optimist, but I believe that Americans, as Americans, will turn out. They will not be turned away from the polls. If the Iraqis aren't going to be turned away from the polls, the Americans aren't going to be turned away from the polls. And the thing to be watching for is that every single ballot count be done with multiple parties there to ensure that it isn't fictionalized.
And more to the point, to make that balloting in person, if at all possible, because it's your surest way to have confidence that you will indeed be heard. Your vote will count and not be lost in the mail or hanging chatted out of, you know, the final tally. Bobby, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid. Coming back to you next week with great enthusiasm, and I look forward to our visit then. Thank you for your time today and for the great work that you do. And also, folks, in addition to checking him out at amac.us, I'm looking into his book, Eagles and Evergreens, a great read. Bobby, it's great to have you with us. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.